Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Real American Man. And we're going to be talking about several different topics today's show. The main topic of conversation, of course, is the topic of conversation today, sorry for that, is the issue that veterans have with their families, their family life, work life, and play. And I guess what I'm talking about there is just the ability to be able to go into extracurricular activities. I see that veterans are finding it harder and harder to do those things. I'm a veteran myself. I spent two tours in Iraq. I was in the Air Force, so they were not necessarily extended tours as some of my Army counterparts and other branches have had to face. Thank you for your service. I spent that time in Iraq. Also went to a couple other countries as well. I will never forget my time in the military. It's something that I cannot, honestly, and this may sound a little bit odd unless you're a veteran, something that I can't really let go of. Even if I wanted to, even if I wanted to move on from it to think about other things, because there were things that I saw and dealt with whenever I was there that I would rather just forget about. But it affects me. It does affect me. And admitting that and accepting that and moving forward with that is something that I think that a lot of us as veterans need to do. There are several things that are frustrating. On the family side of it, you know, we leave our wives and our children at home. They don't go through the war, right? They go through the fear of not hearing from us on a phone call, of being with us on a phone call when we get a rocket attack or we have to abruptly end the conversation and they don't hear from us for another several hours, several days, several weeks. And we have to go through those types of situations, they have to go through those types of situations, but they don't experience it on the same level that we do. And so we come back and we feel like we're all alone, right? You know, and that's something that I think that the Air Force kind of did wrong, right? The Army, my Army counterparts, they were there with their unit. And when they would deploy and when they would redeploy back home, they were there with their unit. You know, they would have a few that would supplement them from other units. But generally speaking, they were all there together, and they would go home together. And so there was this continual continuity from these units to have this shared experience that even though they had gone home and they were no longer in the country of war that they were in, they could go to their buddies and say, you know, man, you know, how are you getting through this? How are you doing this? In the Air Force, we get supplemented all the time. We get supplemented into Army units, into, you know, different squadrons and all kinds of different places. And so a lot of times we are with a particular group of people for a period of time, and then we're not with them anymore. And we go back home to our regular Air Force base, Air Force squadron, and they've not had the exact same experiences as we had. And that was rather tough for me because I was placed with Army counterparts on a pretty regular basis doing internal gate guard for a compound that we were at. And, you know, I dealt with some specific experiences, very specific, very, very difficult experiences that my Air Force counterparts did not experience. Now, I'm not saying that none of them experienced anything, but not exactly that I had experienced. And I remember in particular this one time that we had a rocket attack, and there was a situation where we had to respond. We ended up losing, unfortunately, three Army guys, Army National Guard guys, during that rocket attack, and it was a very sad day. I witnessed them coming through our compound. We had the hospital within our compound, and I witnessed them coming through that gate. And I had to see their bodies, and those images still plague me to this day. And that was back in, gosh, that would have been 2009. And so for me, you know, like I say, so then I come back, and none of my Air Force counterparts were there. None of them experienced that, right? My Army counterparts did, and guess what? My Army counterparts, they had people there. They had their people, the Army people, respond for them, right? There was chaplains that came along and, you know, made sure that everybody was doing okay. But nobody did that for me. Nobody did that for me. And so I kind of just felt completely alone in it. But I see, I took a lot of blame for that rocket attack. We had several instances of, you know, local Iraqis coming through that compound where we felt like that, you know, they were a little bit suspicious, but there was never anything really there to do anything with, right? Seemed odd, but at this point in time, and now that I think about it, it was 2009, the rules of engagement were not such that, you know, I could just yank these people out of the car and stick a, you know, barrel to their head. That was not the rules of engagement. I couldn't do that. It was almost like they, you know, had similar protections. It seemed like that American civilians would, you know, that we needed to have proof before we could just be accusing people or, and I get that. I mean, don't get me wrong, because certainly you can get yourself into trouble with just suspicions and acting on them. But it was rather, you know, there was several times where we had things rather suspicious. But this particular day that we had these rocket attacks where we lost the three Army guys, Army National Guard guys, to these rocket attacks, we had this man and woman, local Iraqis, no doubt about it. They were local Iraqi nationals. They come to our gate, and they're asking questions about the compound. They're wanting to know about this building, that building, and asking, you know, and asking specific, you know, is that your hospital? Is that your JTOC? I can't remember exactly what the abbreviated name was, but basically our operations center. And they had to have identifications on them. They were given cards, color-coded cards, that was supposed to have their picture on it and everything else, and the color code mattered to what their level of, I guess, how they could be on the base, so that whether or not they could be alone or not, whether or not they had to have somebody else with them, another color coded with them. Some of them were where, you know, the color, I think yellow was where they could be on the base by themselves, but they could not be over a red card. Red card always had to have a green card, carded person with them, and the yellow card was not a supervisor in any sort of the way, right? So a red card could not be with a yellow card, and that would happen often, you know, where the yellow card would think that he could take a red card, you know, down to the whatever, you know, wherever they're going, and they would just be them, and there would be no green cards with them, and we'd have to explain it to them. Wasn't really a whole lot we could do about that, but we had this, but they did have to always have it visible. They always had to make sure that they had it on them, they had that visible, so we could always know as soon as we looked at the person, okay, this is what they are, right? And if they were hiding in any sort of way, then there was certain steps that we could take. And so these people come to the gate, and they're in a car. The guy's driving, of course, but the woman was sitting up in the front seat. And these are, I mean, they're Muslims, okay? I guess I shouldn't know that what their religion is, but they were, you know, the woman was dressed in garb and everything, and but she's sitting in the front seat, and I just thought, you know, that's really strange. If you know anything about the more conservative extremist of that faith, which most of these people were, someone in that level, they don't sit in the front seat. I mean, I have been in areas in the United States where I have seen seemingly a Muslim couple, and the man is driving. There's nobody else in the car with them, and the woman is sitting in the back seat. This is just their culture. This is the way that they're raised. And it's not even anything abnormal, right, for them to be doing that. But it is abnormal for it to be the opposite way, especially in that country. You know, you may see it here where there are more progressive family. But there, that just did not happen. And so I'm sitting here going, you know, what is the deal? It automatically looks weird to me as soon as I see them pulling up to the gate. So they get up to the gate, and I ask them, you know, what is it that they're needing? You know, and I don't see any identification, so I ask them where their identification is. The guy had something, he had a lanyard around his neck with a card on it, but it was turned where I couldn't see the color, I couldn't see a picture, I couldn't see nothing. So I knew he had something on him, right, but I couldn't see. The woman didn't have any identification whatsoever on her. But she had this notebook that she had laid out onto her lap, And she was writing things down. So as he was asking questions about this building, that building, right, he wanted to know what these buildings were and what purpose they served. And as he's doing this, he's speaking to her, and the lady in Arabic, and she's writing down. She's writing. And I keep asking him for identification, kept asking him for identification. And I go back to talk with my Army counterparts, to consult with them and to have them help me to try to figure out what is going on. And I turn back around, and this guy has put it in reverse, and he's out of there. He's gone. I sat on it for a minute, and because I'm thinking, you know, I'm overreacting, I'm being paranoid, I'm sure it was nothing. I'd already dealt with the Army on a few occasions, the Army sergeants, and in some things that I had found suspicious, and they kind of looked at me, and if you're an Army person, then you know how it is. And it's just the way it was. They looked at me as though, you know, I was just an Air Force guy, and I didn't really know about those types of things. So they would just kind of shrug it off. So I'm thinking, all right, I don't want to go up to this guy with something like this without me having a little bit more confidence in it, because this is pretty big, you know, what it seemed like that they were doing. So I sat on it, not for very long. I mean, a few minutes, being pretty literal with that. I mean, it couldn't have been 5 minutes at the most. And so I go and I talk to the sergeant, and I let him know what's going on, and just like I suspected, he shrugged it off. And I didn't pursue it. I didn't push it any further than that. But I had this gut feeling that just something was not right. And so my shift was over, and I go back to my barracks, and I'm settling down for the night, and here comes the rocket attacks. And we of course, get ordered to our bunkers. I had a horrible feeling about it, a horrible feeling. Generally speaking, whenever we would get rocket attacks, they were, you know, all over the place. They would always miss us, right? They would always overshoot it, undershoot it, whatever, but they were never on target. They were never on target. And so, but I just had a bad feeling this time. And so instead of going to the bunker, I decided, I put on my gear, I got my rifle, and I headed out to the gate. Our barracks were almost right beside this interior gate. And so I get up and I go there, and to the gate, and I start trying to help. And that's whenever I see these bodies coming through. And I'm thinking, man, please tell me that nobody died. Please tell me that nobody got killed in this. And as the development started to come around, we found out that two of them were dead before they could ever even get them to the hospital. I think one of them may have made it to the hospital, but they never got off the ground. They were needing to take them to a better hospital because of the level of the injuries that they had sustained. And so they get them, and they get one guy into a helicopter and try to get him to look. And they don't get him there. They don't get him there in time. And so, yeah, so that's my story. I just wanted to do a really quick short show today, I guess. I've been plagued with that, with the feelings of guilt, to a level of PTSD. You know, it really has bothered me a lot. I don't have a whole lot of time left on this show. It's just a 15-minute show. But a lot of veterans are coming back, and they have this PTSD. They have physical ailments. They have internal ailments. And it's so difficult to just move on. And one of the things that's so frustrating is that in family life, like I say, it's like we're all alone. You know, here we are at this house. Obviously, we love these people. These people know who we are outside of the military, outside of the war. But they don't know what we went through in the war. It makes us feel very, very alone. And in work, it's so frustrating because it's like nobody appreciates what we've done. You know, we're looked at like we just got out of high school, like we've just been playing around while we were in the military. And it seems like it's not honored. And then for play, it's like we can't relax. You know, it's just very, very difficult to relax. I was hoping that I was going to have more time than this. I had a few interruptions today, and so I didn't really get a whole lot of chance to talk about it. I do want to do another show on this. We'll try to do this on Saturdays, and I'll be doing it earlier in the day. I'll probably try to do a noon show on Saturday. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much. God bless you all. Have a great day.